kind of ambition that is required can only be achieved through real and scaled up climate finance, which is currently missing.
At the 29th UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, held in November 2024, developing nations put pressure on wealthy, high-emitting countries to increase financial assistance to help them cope with the effects of the climate crisis and support the transition to a low-carbon economy. What's known as the New Collective Quantified Goal was agreed on after negotiators agreed to raise $300 billion a year in climate finance, triple the original target by 2035. However, this figure doesn't account for inflation, and some feel it still falls short of what is needed to tackle the severity of the crisis. David Waskow, Director of the International Climate Initiative at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C.
There was some degree of movement on financing issues. The issue at stake was that countries needed to agree, according to previous decisions, on a new finance goal, a new global finance goal. And this was the first time, really, in 15 years that this was under discussion. Countries ultimately ended up agreeing that there would be a new goal of $300 billion a year that would be mobilized, and that that would be by 2035. Now, the term mobilized is important because it represents, in large part, public finance, but then also private finance that's leveraged directly by that public finance. So that's the way in which the $300 billion goal is understood. We now have more of an opening for developing countries to be part of contributing. The most important shift on that was that there was agreement that on a voluntary basis, essentially, all countries would have their contributions to the multilateral development banks that go to climate finance recognized as part of the goal, as part of what has been done to meet the goal. So those MDB numbers, those multilateral development bank numbers, are quite substantial. It'll end up probably being the majority of climate finance going forward. And unlike the past, when only 70% the developed country share was counted, it will now be 100% that's counted. So that was a core outcome. The other outcome on finance, just to quickly note, is that there was also agreement on a sort of overarching finance goal of $1.3 trillion a year. And that number really reflects all financial flows to developing countries. So not just what comes from public monies and what's leveraged by those, but the whole suite of finance that might go to developing countries that's based on some work that Nick Stern and others have done to assess what's needed in financial flows to be on track for 1.5 degrees. And that number, it calls on all actors to enable that financing, is the language in the text. So it's quite broad. And this next year will really be a period during which how one gets there will be explored. The outcome from COP29 also put in motion what it called a Baku to Belém roadmap on the 1.3T, I'm quoting precisely. And so how one gets there, what that 1.3 trillion looks like, how we actually enable it coming from all actors will be an important subject of discussion this year, particularly because it's the amount that we know is ultimately needed. So well beyond the 300 billion to get there.
Harjeet Singh, Global Engagement Director of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, based in New Delhi, assesses the outcome of COP29 from the perspective of developing countries.
The reason we are not able to make progress on ambitious climate action over the last few years and decades is because there is not sufficient money in the system to help developing countries make that transition. And of course, developed countries are obligated to provide climate finance owing to their historical responsibility. When we went to the COP, we were expecting a bold and ambitious new climate finance goal, which would replace the $100 billion goal that was set as part of Paris Agreement, but was announced way back in 2009. And the reality is what has been offered is a paltry sum, exactly what Indian government said, which is about $300 billion annually. But I must also mention that not only it is woefully inadequate, but also the target to achieve that annual goal is 2035, which is too little and too late. And also, the details that have been attached to that goal are so vague that it's going to be extremely hard to track the real finance, and it puts no pressure whatsoever on developed countries to mobilize new money. So because of all these reasons, not only India, but also Nigeria that supported India's objections, but just a few days before that, least developed countries and island states even briefly walked out of the negotiations. So the amount of frustration and the anger that we have seen at this COP is unprecedented. Me, in my own individual capacity, I'm saying let's junk the COP29 deal. No deal is better than a bad deal. Because if we stick to this, we are actually stuck with it for 11 long years, which is going to be devastating, because the kind of ambition that is required can only be achieved through real and scaled up climate finance, which is currently missing.
Emily Morrison, a project lawyer working in the areas of climate change, ESG, and business and human rights within the IBA Legal Policy and Research Unit, discusses how lawyers can take forward what was agreed at COP29.
Coming away from the negotiations, I think that there's going to be such an important role for lawyers to play in translating those signals from COP29 outcomes, you know, whether that be in the NCQG text on climate finance, which does provide some really important signals around what multilateral development banks are going to be doing going through to 2035, what governments, what private sector actors can all be playing in both providing and mobilizing climate finance. I think lawyers have a really important role to play in translating those signals. Another important outcome at this conference was around Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which provides for international carbon markets. Perhaps one of the greater victories of this conference was that the rules for operationalizing those markets were finalized. And lawyers, in my view, can play a really important role in translating those highly technical documents into implementation for governments, for communities to understand, for private sector actors who are interested in being involved in the market to understand as well, because there is certainly a lack of understanding, I think, and a lot of learning to be done in that space that I think lawyers can really assist with. And the only other point that I'd like to touch on is the fact that at COP29, one of the focus areas was looking at what countries' new nationally determined contributions under the Paris Agreement will look like. There was a lot of encouragement for parties to be submitting those ahead of or during the COP. And we did see a number of nations, a small number, but a number nonetheless, launch their new nationally determined contributions during COP29. And lawyers will, of course, play a really critical role in translating those plans into law, into policy, helping their private sector clients understand what that nationally determined contribution actually means for investment opportunities, for example, for risk. So I think there's a lot of work for lawyers to be doing in that space as well, as we see all countries party to the Paris Agreement submit those new plans.
Both David and Harjeet highlight the continued need for multilateral dialogue and action, despite the challenges.
We're teetering on the edge of whether we can actually keep temperatures limited to 1.5 degrees. And there will likely be in the coming year a sense that perhaps the Paris process, the UNFCCC process, is not fit for purpose to deal with the climate crisis. I think there are things that we need to do to improve the international process. We also have lots of these cooperative agreements and initiatives among governments that are not terribly accountable. There's not a lot of transparency about what they're achieving or not. Their institutional base is often very weak. So both the Paris regime and these kind of cooperative initiatives really need to be strengthened and improved. But I think we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think there could be a real danger this coming year of people suggesting that this just isn't the thing that's going to work. And let's move on to something. But I don't know that anybody has something else that they have in mind to move on to that would be effective.
You don't achieve everything in 1 year. And each year, each process actually is part of that journey or milestone that you have to achieve. But when I look to COP30, I get really worried, because when COP29 failed on so many counts, We did not agree on how to implement the plan that we got or the decision that we got at COP28 on transitioning away from fossil fuels and tripling renewable energy and doubling energy efficiency. And again, the reason was because there was no finance. We have not agreed on just transition work program. We have not agreed on global goal on adaptation indicators, and the list goes on. So the COP30 is now going to have a massive agenda. And we know that we are not going to be achieving everything there. But then we, as climate justice advocates, we have to lay down a roadmap on how we are going to achieve the global justice and what we can leverage in these spaces. I think that is extremely important. So looking at it as part of a journey and then trying to make sure that we get the best in some of these processes, but not only depending on that, and a lot of work needs to happen at the national level in the capitals, because what we see happening in these global forum is culmination of what happens or doesn't happen in the capital. So if we really have to go back to the grassroots and mobilize people and put pressure on governments around the world, both in the developed and developing countries.